The Merkel is a vestige of this whole lost category of housing, the residential hotel. These buildings once filled a crucial niche for low-income workers and immigrants, a bridge between affordable housing and something like a shelter. These single-room occupancy hotels, or SROs, used to dominate the streetscape in Seattle's Chinatown International District. Now, they're nearly extinct. It's a story that caught the attention of Marie Wong, an associate professor at Seattle University. It appealed to her background in urban planning, but also to her background as a Chinese-American growing up in the Midwest.
It wasn't until I started talking with people in the district that I realized that it was the same type of building that my father chose for us to stay in when we would go from Iowa to the Chinese restaurants that were in Minneapolis, Rochester, and Chicago. And every time we would go to one of these cities, my dad wanted to stay in one of these buildings. Every fall, he would do the harvest, and we had apple trees and pear trees, and he would grow Chinese vegetables, and they would share news of China, news about people that they would collectively know. And he would bring them fresh fruits and vegetables, and in exchange, they would give him meats and fish and that sort of thing. So that was kind of the annual fall trip. This was around the time period when, you know, motels were showing up all over the place on highways and freeways outside of central cities. And that's where we wanted to stay, but that's not where my dad wanted to stay.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that a lot of it may have had to do with the fact that this is where he stayed when he was an immigrant into the United States, because it would have fit that same time period, that my dad was also one of those transient laborers, that he did a lot of work. In fact, he was a cook in the restaurants when he was traveling throughout the United States. And this was the place where he could connect with people that he knew. So that was as important to him as staying in any other hotel or any other motel that would have been existing in the city.
And what are residential hotels? How are they different from a Days Inn?
Well, they were constructed primarily between 1880 and up until about the 1930s. They're very modest structures, kind of low to mid-rise, 2 to 6 floors in height. And they were intended for really modest income individuals to stay. So they're small rooms. And literally, there's very little room for anything in the room other than maybe a bed. Bathrooms are always located in the hall, so it's kind of like a dormitory style.
And people would, I presume, when we're talking about residents, these are not places that people would go to stay for a night or two necessarily.
You know, I think the benefit of residential hotels is that you literally could stay for however long you wanted to. So there were a lot of people that would stay for a night, a couple of nights, a week, a month, and there were a lot of people who ended up staying literally their lifetime.
Why did they exist? What role did they play in the economy of that period of time?
Around 1880, you start to see a lot of immigration into the country and a lot of migration into cities, because this is the place where they had opportunities for work. In the early years, you could stay in a residential hotel for 5 cents, 10 cents, a quarter. If you were going to stay for a longer period of time, you'd get a special rate. So you might be able to stay in a residential hotel for a month for maybe anywhere from $7.50 to $10 for the month.
What were the perceptions of other, you know, of neighbors, of more affluent citizens, of kind of mainstream culture at the time toward the SROs in Chinatown International District?
Yeah, well, they definitely were looked at as individuals who were down on their luck, that these were, you know, I hate to say it, but they were looked at the time as being kind of the dregs of society. These were individuals that didn't have great social connections, that they were people who were alone and lonely. And it was looked at as a location of kind of moral depravity.
Can you tell me more about the culture of like one of these buildings, for example? I mean, would people know each other? Would there be, you know, places to interact? Or is there a life of a building? Or was it really just people kind of living out their own individual lives in their individual rooms?
it would be virtually impossible to live in a room without having any kind of interaction at all with people who are living in the building. And
especially if you share a bathroom.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that you're going to be walking through the hallways, even if you wanted to eat something, because there weren't any kitchens, so there was no communal kitchen. There was no kitchen in the rooms because they were so incredibly small. So it was expected that your life was going to interact with the greater community and that you would leave the building to have that interaction. So it was incredibly lively.
What role did they play as a safety net for people of modest means who needed a roof?
You know, Seattle, right around the turn of the 20th century, was going through, all this is going to sound so familiar and so contemporary, but we were going through a housing crisis. We didn't have enough housing to provide for people that were coming into the city for work opportunities. And so the residential hotels were, they were the places where you knew that you could get a room at least temporarily. Maybe you want it just for a couple of nights while you're looking for work. And then you could make longer-term decisions on where you ultimately wanted to stay. The people who would manage these hotels started to take a very strong interest in all of the individuals who would live in their buildings. One example, Mrs. Tokita took care of literally everybody who lived in the New Lucky Hotel. She was very mindful of the fact that there were a number of the residents that were, you know, strapped financially. There were also individuals that had problems with drug addiction, with alcoholism. And, you know, still, if you were the manager of one of these hotels, you took it very personally that these were the individuals that were under your care and under your charge.
Again, you gave this, the heyday is kind of the 1880s to, you know, 1930s Depression era. What happened after that to the residential hotels of Seattle?
The catalysts for closing residential hotels were major public works projects. So the interstates were being constructed. Typically, these would be located in areas of the city that were deemed kind of expendable areas. And those expendable areas, unfortunately, were often minority community areas. So we lost a number of residential hotels from that. And for Seattle, we had a major fire of one of the residential hotels that was located in the north part of the downtown. The fire was the second worst that had taken place in residential hotels in the nation. And the city started taking it very seriously because with the loss of life, they were also concerned with lawsuits. And so now all of a sudden, the city gave residential hotel owners 1 year to comply with fire codes. And for the people who owned and operated the hotels, these were never huge money-making operations. You know, people were just barely squeaking by a living. So all of a sudden, if you have a bill for upgrading the doors in your hotel alone, you know, at the time in 1972, we're talking about a bill for $11,000, which right now in 2018 dollars would be about $57,000. Now, how are you going to do that if you're charging, you know, $10 a month? They just couldn't do it. You know, the city thought that the worst that could happen was that we would probably lose about 1,000 low-income housing units. And it ended up being three times that amount within the first year of its passage.
Wow. Did that have a noticeable effect? I mean, where did those people go?
That's a good question. Nobody actually thought about the relocation of individuals. They didn't think about where the money was going to come from. You know, it's one thing to pass the ordinance, and it's another thing to say, well, we've got a plan in place that will help you with loans or will help you with some kind of a grant that would enable people who operated these hotels to stay in business.
What is the district like today? What are these buildings like today in the Chinatown International District? If we were to go take a walk down there, what would we see?
We still have a core group of residential hotels that are protected as part of the historic district of the CID. And I'm going to say they're in kind of varying states of vacancy, restoration. There are, I'm going to say, a couple of residential hotels that are still in operation, but they can't cater to that one-night stay anymore.
Yeah. And What would you say to somebody who says, okay, these residential hotels were pretty ugly, squalid, you know, they were basically a big kind of product of poverty. Why should we be celebrating them? You know, why do you think that they are worth knowing more about and kind of honoring the history of them?
You know, at the risk of shameless promotion, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book Building Tradition, because I wanted people to understand the building type, the effect of urbanism, the need for low-income housing, the solution that people came to with providing these hotels, but also the lives of individuals who made their homes in these buildings, who raised their families in these buildings. And they were much, much more than just the brick and mortar that we look at now. These really were people's souls and their hearts and their lives, their history.